for joining us again for the second part of this three-part series featuring Rabbi Alan Schwartz on his current book, Conflict and Resolution in the Early Prophets. Last week's topic was categories of resolution in the early prophets. Tonight, Rabbi Schwartz will be talking about categories of perpetrators. For those of you that do not know, Rabbi Schwartz is Rabbi Ohav Zedek in Manhattan, alumnus of Yeshiva College, and received his master's degree in Bible, Rabbinics, and Halakha from Yeshiva University's affiliated Rabbi Isaac Elkanan Theological Seminary. He currently holds the Raymond J. Greenwald Chair in Jewish Studies at Yeshiva University, where he's taught since 1993. And we're excited to have him back tonight for the second part of this series. Again, we will have the prior clips and tonight's clips uploaded to the Beth Aaron YouTube webpage, and Rabbi Schwartz will have a copy as well that will be uploaded to YU Torah. With that, I'll hand it over to Rabbi Schwartz. Thank you again for tonight's topic.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for coming back. And we're on part two of our discussion of conflict resolution in the books of the prophets. Thank you, Jesse, for arranging this. And I look forward to learning with all of you again. The schedule is to learn for the presentation to go on for about 45 minutes, and then I'll leave time for questions at the end, and I'll wrap everything up for this session. The third week, we'll be doing two particular cases, one involving Shaul, one involving David, both in Sefer Shmuel. Okay, so the treatment of the biblical persona, we discussed very briefly last time the idea that especially the patriarchs were so perfect that we're supposed to model our lives by them. The Medrash says in Bereishis Rabbah, everyone should ask, when will my deeds be like that of, like those of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? And also a Medrash in Tana Devei Eliyahu that says that on every day we should be asking ourselves, how can I imitate Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? The Avos, or were called in Bereishis Rabbah, the Merkava. They were the chariot, the veritable chariot that Yechezkel speaks of, which is a conduit between God and humanity. Those were the Avos who brought God down for the human race to, in order for their descendants to receive God's divine word. And yet, the same author of these midrashim, the second one happens to be Reish Lakish, they're sometimes critical of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. These are human beings. Human beings err. They sin. Even Moshe Rabbeinu, the most perfect of all, our great, great defender of the biblical character, Rashi, particularly concentrates on one foible of Moshe throughout the Torah, and points out that whenever Moshe succumbs to this particular foible of his, that he is always errs and has some kind of mistake in halacha, or is not even given a chance to teach the halacha, and that foible is his anger. So our commentaries appear to have a realistic approach. I would like to divide my study of this particular presentation into three time periods. One I'm going to call Chazal. By Chazal, I mean Gemaras, Midrashim, Targumim, from the time that rabbinic literature starts to be put to writing, around the time of the Tanoim, until the close of the Talmud, the close of the Midrashim. We'll put that into the Saboraic period. And then you have the time of the Saboraim and the Gaonim, leading up to the Rishonim, did not produce so much material that we have in our hands today, so there's not much to speak of. The Rishonim, starting with, let's say, Sadiko and Rashi, the end of the Gaonic period and the Rishonim period, that's going to be the second discussion we'll have, and then we'll see a smattering of Achronim. And by Achronim, I'm going to, although there are many different time periods, usually the Achronim begin about the beginning of the 16th century, I'm going to push that a little later. Okay, so let's see. Well, let's start first with that very famous Gemara in Masechet Shabbos that says that David didn't sin, Eli's sons didn't sin, Shmuel's sons didn't sin, Reuven didn't sin, Shlomo didn't sin. What does all that mean? We discussed that to some extent last week. I just want to say that a commentary like Rashi, Bechor Shor, even Ibn Ezra, Chizkuni, those who have Torah commentaries as well as Nevi'im commentaries in addition, like Ralbag, they don't mind shoving B'nai Eli and B'nai Shmuel under the bus. They'll say B'nai Eli, B'nai Shmuel did what the text says they did. They're as bad as they look. But on the other hand, Reuven and Gad, and mostly Shlomo, those biblical characters are very much protected. The commentaries go out of their way to show that Reuven did not do what the text says he did, namely to violate Yaakov's wife, Bilhah. Now, when the rabbis were so kind, if you will, to Reuven, I think what's going on there is a simple Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. It's called Hevedon es kol ha'adam lekaf zchus. Let me explain what's going on here. The Mishnah does not say Hevedon es kol adam lekaf zchus. No, that means judge every person favorably. There's no such rule. We are not enjoined to judge everybody favorably. Not everybody deserves to be judged favorably. Rather, the Mishnah says, "Hevedon es kol ha'adam lekaf zchus." Judge the entire individual favorably. So, when the commentaries or the midrashim decided that the entirety of the individual deserved to be judged favorably, they tended to judge whatever they did favorably. Reuven is one of the heads of the tribes. And there's too much at stake to say he did what the text says he did. And the same is true for David. David initiates the messianic line of Malchus David straight through Mashiach. And we turn to him when we don't have the right words for Tehillim, so for our prayers. And therefore, the rabbis considered it of great import to judge David favorably, because they looked at the entire individual. If you look at the entirety of Yaakov, we will judge his behavior in Parshas Toldos favorably. On the other hand, what happens with the rabbis is let's start to contrast, let's say, Avraham with Lot. Avraham and Lot behave very similarly when they entertain the angels, yet Bereishis Rabbah, and to some extent Rashi, is critical of things that Lot does, which is very comparable to what Avraham does. So there, what's happening with Lot, I suggested the first week, is something I coined the term Ma'ase Bonim Siman La'avos. Lot gets treated very harshly in rabbinic literature because of who his descendants became. If Ammon and Moab became some of our worst enemies, the only two nations, right, to the exclusion of Amalek also, that are not allowed to convert. An Amaleki is allowed to join our kehillah and marry into our religion, but Ammonites and Moabites, at least the men, cannot. And those are Lot's descendants. Plus, if you look at the entirety of the individual Lot, this is the way the Midrashim, this is the way the Rishonim analyzed his personality. He departs from Avraham and he ends up in Sodom. He doesn't get the picture that he is exiled from and taken captive from Sodom, and Avraham saves him in chapter 14, and lo and behold, we find him back there again. What's he doing back in Sodom? He didn't get the memo the first time that he didn't belong there? I know why he liked to go there, because the Torah calls Sodom Kigan Hashem Ke'eretz Mitzrayim, so that when Lot was in Egypt with Avraham back in chapter 12 and 13, he couldn't leave. Right, Egypt is too far, but he had a closer place that was just like Egypt. It was called Sodom. So he kept going back. He kept rejecting Avraham to go back to Sodom. Well, guess what? Not only did Lot reject Avraham, Avraham rejected Lot. When Avraham said to God, "I have no children, who's inheriting me?" He said, "My butler, Damesek Eliezer, is inheriting me." Damesek Eliezer, for goodness sakes, you have a nephew. He should have said, "My nephew is inheriting me." We see that Avraham rejected Lot. So when the rabbis judged people in Tanakh, they looked at events such as this. They looked at the total picture, and they said, "Have they done this kol ha'adam?" In the case of someone like Lot, l'kaf chova, or someone like Esav, have they done l'kaf chova? Right, so that they become judged disfavorably, and And so Yehuda has some very questionable behavior in chapter 38 of Bereishis. And yet the rabbis are quite favorable about the conclusion of the story, because when you come right down to it, these discussions of the rabbis of how to view the perpetrator, it's not about the tzidkus of the person. It's about the struggle. It's about the what the person ends up becoming. The rabbis were willing to say in the beginning of the second parak in Maseches Yuma that Shaul was a much greater specimen of human morality than David. You heard that. Go look at Daf Chav Beis in Maseches Yuma, and it says that Shaul was phenomenally innocent. He was an innocent like a one-year-old, and David is struggles much more with his morality than Shaul does. But that was the problem, because Shaul's assuredness in his own mind of how perfect he was made it impossible for him to say the simple word chatasi, which comes so easily and readily to David. So this is the difference between Shaul and David. It's not a question of what they are, but what they become. This is part of a very, very, it's quite a famous, I don't know, I can't call it a medrash. Its source is highly questionable. It appears for the first time in the Shita Mekubetzes in Maseches Nedarim. It's quoted very famously in the Tiferes Yisrael at the end of Maseches Kiddushin, and was put into an article in Tradition magazine, I'd say about 15 years ago, by Dr. Schneer Lyman, in an article called The Portrait of Moses. The story is about an Arab king who wants very badly to meet Moshe because he heard that he is such a specimen of perfection. He finally has an opportunity not to meet him, but to have a sculptor sculpt a bust of Moshe's face so he can just behold this specimen of perfection. And after composing this bust, I don't know if Moshe sat for it. Maybe he found Moshe while he was sitting in the Beis Medrash learning, and he just made a picture of him and created the bust of Moshe's face and brought it home to a physiognomist. The physiognomist it's an ancient art, but it's still practiced in many places, where you determine an individual's characteristics based on their facial features. And when the physiognomist beheld Moshe's bust of Moshe's face, he said, "This man is a murderer. He's given to every vice known to man. I can't believe that you heard that this man is a specimen of perfection." So the king was very upset, and he said, "From what I heard, is that this man is perfect. So the next time I get to go to him, I'm going to take the bust with me, I'm going to hold it up to his head, and I'm going to see that if it's an exact likeness, I'm going to kill the physiognomist for lying. And if it's not a good likeness, I'm going to kill the sculptor for not making a good sculpture." So he gets to see Moshe shortly afterwards. He takes the bust to Moshe, puts it up near his face, and sees in its exact likeness, in which case he wants to kill the physiognomist for lying about Moshe. At which time Moshe holds back the king and says, "No, don't touch that man. Everything he said about me is true. I am all those things. It's just that I have struggled my entire life to move away from those things." Okay, now whether or not this is truly should be considered a Jewish source, this such a story takes up the whole page of the last daf of Maseches Kiddushin in the Mishnayos. You can look at it and see it's on the Tiferes Yisrael side. You should know that when Rav Maimon led the education department in Israel, he made sure that all Mishnayos printed in Israel in the 50s and the 60s omit this page. He didn't like it. He didn't consider a Jewish source. Full disclosure, there are similar stories told about Socrates and about Cicero, much predating this story. Again, it does not appear in any of our Medrash Rabbahs or any Gemaras, Shas Bavli, Yerushalmi. It just appears in the Shita Mekubetzes out of nowhere. And he says, "I saw it on Medrash." And the Tiferes Yisrael, this is the 16th century, 17th century, and he says, I saw it in the Medrash. What Medrash? Where is it? Anyway, this source seems to defy a Zohar. The Zohar says that when Moshe chose judges to help him in Parshas Yisro, it didn't say in the pasuk Vatot Tivchar, it said Vatot Techezeh. The Zohar says that Moshe looked into the faces of individuals to determine whether they would be a good judge. So Moshe was quite the physiognomist himself. But physiognomy does not detect what you are in your personality in your when you were born, so to say, but what you are now. If Moshe at the time was a specimen of perfection, the physiognomist should have detected that, not who he actually was in his potential. Does the physiognomist determine your potential or your actual? In that medrash about Moshe, it only detects his potential. That's why he came across as a murderer. The first thing Moshe does in the Torah is kill somebody. He kills an Egyptian. It's the first action he does in the Torah, right? But in the Zohar, the physiognomist does not detect your potential. It detects your actual. If Moshe is going to test judges, he doesn't want to know what their potential personality is. He wants to know what their actual personality is. So the Zohar seems to contradict this Medrash. Okay, I hope you can see all that. Okay, so look at that. It's called The Portrait of Moses, Schneer Lyman, if you want to see more about that. But this only brings home the point I'm trying to make, is that to the rabbis, it's not how perfect you are. I think I mentioned last week that the rabbis did not consider the four individuals who never sinned, Binyamin, Amram, Kilav, and Yishai, to be anywhere as great as their close relatives, Yosef, Moshe, David, and Shlomo. I'd rather have the last four on my biblical dream team than the first four. It's just that the first four were perfect. They didn't have to struggle. There was no struggle. They weren't out there. They weren't out in the world, real world. They weren't Ba'aretz, B'soch Ha'ir, B'chutzos Yerushalayim. Right? They were in hiding inside, like a tzaddik in pelts. Right? Our rabbis always considered someone to be greater who was out there, even though that might detract from the perfection. Okay. So it's all about the struggle. I might add to this the pasuk at the very end of Sefer Micha, Titein Emes LeYaakov VeChesed LeAvraham. So in rabbinic literature, you see that Yaakov is Emes, Avram is Chesed, Yitzchak is Yiro or Kedusha. But the reason why they are these things is because they did not come so readily to them. Yeah, Avram is always the man of Chesed, not so fast. The man of Chesed somehow found it within his soul to take his son up to a mountain, you know, even though he knew what that would mean to the child's mother. He found it in his soul to send away his son Yishmael with nothing but a canteen of water and a loaf of bread. Avram had to struggle for Chesed. As we all know, Yaakov had to struggle for Emes. Ki kol achot, Yaakov, Yaakov, says Yirmiyahu in chapter 9. It's a struggle, and they worked hard at it. And that's what makes our great characters so great. And that's what makes us rabbis have someone to talk about on Shabbos morning. Because if we create a biblical persona that is too difficult for someone to grasp, then what's the point of making a sermon about Yaakov's behavior on the Shabbos morning? If my congregants are going to say, yeah, Rabbi, that's Yaakov. I have to live in the real world. No, Yaakov lived in a very real world, similar to that of all of us. He lived with jealousy. He lived with competition. He lived with all kinds of issues that we live with. And he struggled with them. So it's all about the struggle. Titein emes liyakov, titein, give it to them, because that's part of their struggle. Okay? So this is, so far, part one, the Midrashim. I would like to propose to you, and if you are getting my book, to write, jot down the number 146. On page 146, I don't mean to just randomly collect these, but I give a list of very realistic midrashim in Bereishis Rabbah that discuss some of the questionable deeds of our patriarchs and matriarchs in Sefer Bereishis. It is not true that Ramban was the first one to question the deeds of our forefathers. It's really not so. Bereishis Rabbah is extremely realistic in presenting the Avos and the Imahos. You have to read the whole thing. They were the Merkava. They brought God down to humanity. And for that, we will always be eternally grateful. And every in all our prayers, we will say, Mishaber, Chavosein, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, when we make a Mishaberach, we will always quote them because they were the conduits, the first conduits. What happened, I suspect, in the time of the Rishonim has to do with a phenomenon that takes place at the turn of the first millennia. Around the year 1000, Christians were sure that the second coming was upon us. And if only we can get all those Jews to convert, then this time it'll succeed, right? They ruined it the first time. And this time, if we could just get those Jews to convert, the second coming will be what the first coming wasn't. So there was a great push at first to have these disputations where Jews were called upon to defend the Tanakh, to defend our tenets, and they went on the offensive. And, you know, the Jew often didn't know whether it was better to win or to lose, because if you won the debate, you might get killed for being blasphemous, right? The Jew was always given burdensome and onerous rules about how they could debate. And if you lost the debate, you often were punished or were banished or worse. So who knows what could happen for losing the debate while tenaciously holding on to your rebellion against Jesus. So there are some scholars who claim that these debates are what catapulted the Pshat Parshanut, right? Jews were perfectly satisfied to study the biblical text from the standpoint of Drash, meaning the Babylonian and Jerusalem Talmud, meaning the Targumim, meaning all the Midrashim. Right, in the whole entire Talmud, the statement "Ein mikra yotzei pshuto" appears 3 times. "Pashtei dekra b'maksiv" appears 5 times. So you're not getting a good pshat orientation by reading the Talmudim in Midrashim. Right, all of a sudden, around the year 1000, people start saying, "Let me write a commentary that is pshat." So some scholars claim that Christian polemic is what led to this. If a Christian wants to prove that Isaiah 7:14, "Hineha alma harav yoledet ben," is a proof of the virgin birth of Jesus, so the Jew had made short shrift of this. First of all, your argument is spurious philologically. The word Alma does not mean virgin. Besula means virgin. Alma means a young girl, and in some psukim in the Tanakh describes a married woman. 2, it's grammatically spurious. Hora means is pregnant. The whole point of that prophecy was to lend assurance to the king Ochaz to have faith in God not to join a coalition between Aram and the northern tribes against Ashur, because a young child is going to save you from them, and that was his own son Chizkiyahu. So the birth of arguably from a virgin 600 years from now is not going to serve as any faith impetus for Achaz at this time to not join this coalition. So it's contextually off base. And the prophecy begins with the word Hineh, which implies that it's before you, not something 600 years from now. So it's philologically unsound. It's grammatically unsound. It is contextually unsound. And it's realistically unsound. Virgins don't give birth. Okay, I know you might come to me and say Chagiga Yedalad Besula Shivra Mahil Kohen Gadol, but it's just look, God's hand can perform anything, but these started to be the building blocks of pshat, philology. What does the word mean, right? Grammar, diktuk, syntax, context, reality. So when the Jews started arguing against the Christians, they started to recognize the value of Pshat Parshanut. And it also affects our study tonight. Because in the Middle Ages, when the Christians were arguing about the Jewish the superiority of the Christian over the Jew, they started to argue over the superiority of the New Testament over, I don't like to say the old, I say it's the Hebrew Bible. Right? You ever hear of Gustav and Isaac Doré? They were two brothers who painted hundreds and hundreds of biblical portraits. So I have their book on the Tanakh. It's brilliant, brilliant black and white pictures. I've seen their work on the New Testament. All of their Tanakh pictures are violent pictures. David holding up Goliath's head, you know, Shaul's men and David's men fighting, you know, all the Shmuel pictures are all violent pictures. And all the New Testament pictures are these peaceful, peaceful. Well, you know, you can hear the birds chirping in the background, right? And it's such an arrogant assurance of the superiority of the New Testament, and along with that came an insolent and almost a vehement attack of certain biblical characters, especially Yaakov. They took the side of Esav and everything Yaakov. It's interesting because in Jewish literature, Christianity became Edom. Whether that's genealogically appropriate or not, the last Idumeans converted to Judaism in the second century BCE. So I don't know how Christianity becomes Edom, but okay, it is. If the Radak says Edom is Christianity, then I'll say so. But the Christians sided with Esav in any kind of conflict that he has with Yaakov. So you can understand that if Jews were exposed to this, this is an argument made by David Berger in his book on Christian polemics, that the Jews exposed to this became sort of, you know, defenders. Don't you speak that way about Yaakov, right? So you have commentaries, especially in the Christian world. Rashi is a great defender, like Bechor Shor, who says it's Esav behaving immorally in that story. He should have told his father, "Daddy, I appreciate that you want to give me this bracha, but it's not mine. I sold it to my brother when we were younger." Right? He, in effect, says that later in the story when he says, "Now I know why his name is Yaakov. This is the second time he tricked me." So Yitzchak said, "Second time? When did he do something like this before?" "Yeah, I know. He did that before. Because he said, it's Bechorah Silakach. Bechorah Silakach? When did he take your Bechorah?" And then he told him the story. He goes, "You did that? Gam Baruch Yiyeh." Okay? He took what's his. Okay? I must tell you, I have a radical, radical approach to this. I'm not saying it's correct, but it's an approach. That the two people who were hoodwinked in Parshas Toldos were not Yitzchak and Esav. The two people who were hoodwinked, hold on to your seats, were Yaakov and Esav. Yitzchak was totally in on it. They just had to make it look like Yaakov took it with subterfuge rather than Yitzchak wanting to give it to Yaakov, because then Esav would start to hate his father and lose the one redeeming aspect of his life, which was his beautiful Kibbutz Avaim. Okay, but put that in the background for now. You'll read that in my book. So you understand that the rabbis became sort of the Rishonim became lefnim mishuras hadin to defend the biblical character. So I must say I'm not sure that this is the best reason to think that it's that the Rishonim became much greater defenders of let's say characters like Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov Moshe David. The Rishonim are definitely greater defenders than the Chazal. Okay, take a survey, you'll see. I'm not sure if it's because of Christian polemics. One of the greatest defenders of our biblical persona is Ibn Ezra, and he had very little to do with Christian polemics. And one of our greatest polemicists, two greatest polemicists in the whole Tanakh, which is Radak and Ramban, you may know, were two great, great realistic commentaries, right? They were extremely critical of especially the Avos and Imahos, Radak and Ramban together. So to say that if you polemicize with Christians, you're more likely to view the biblical persona more favorably has to stand up to this scrutiny of Ibn Ezra and Ramban and Radak. I'm not so sure. Okay. So this is the second stage. The third stage is the Achronim, and there I have to tell you, all bets are off. Here it's really it depends who you're calling your Achronim. But here it depends. You have to just see the source. The Netziv thinks that all of those Rambans that are critical of Avraham Yitzchok and Yaakov, right? Ramban says that Sarah sinned a great sin in her affliction of Hagar, and that's why Hagar's descendants, the Muslims, afflict us to this day. Wow. Ramban went one step further than the Midrashim, the Midrashim did understand something called Masa Avo Simon Labanim, which means that some misdeed by Yaakov and Bereishis may have a ripple effect to the very end of Tanakh, right? Vayitzak tze'akah gedola umara ad me'od is the reaction of Esav from Yaakov taking the bracha, and very similar wording is used to describe Mordechai, Yaakov's descendant, Mordechai's reaction to Haman's decree, Haman who is Esav's descendant. That the biblical author, says Bereishis Rabbah, purposely described Mordechai's reaction in a way that will make your biblical ear tingle when you remind yourself of the psukim in Parshas Toldos. So careful are the rabbis to exact any kind of recompense for something that is questionable from our ancestors. They did not sweep their deeds under the carpet. They pointed to their struggles, they pointed to their actions. I think that the Rishonim and Achronim tended to do that. The Netziv claims that all these Rambans are not actually Ramban. That's very difficult. They all appear in the manuscripts. They just to think that someone went in there and inserted these Ramban, I don't know. It's hard to fathom, right? I must tell you that there is your most realistic, and it's very easy to get this commentary. Your most realistic commentary is Shimshon Falhirsch. You should just rush to hear every word he has to say about Avraham Yitzchok and Yaakov. Tirat Tzvi is the best compendium of his commentary, all in one volume in English. Did I say Tirat? It's Trumat Tzvi. Trumat Tzvi is the English translation of Shimshon Falhirsch, and he has his pedagogical theory in advising parents of child rearing from the mistakes. Yeah, there's some mistakes that are made in Sefer Bereishis is just incredible. It's good to read just at the time of Pesach, because Pesach, the Haggadah, is in itself an incredible tool of pedagogy in presenting the Haggadah to four different types of children. Okay? All right. Well, since I'm Alec Goldstein is going to make a plug for the book that is the source of this, I make a shameless plug for my Haggadah. It's called The Four Sons Haggadah, which is divides everything in the Haggadah into four categories for four different types of children. Okay, so back to the Chazal, the Rishonim, and the Achronim, and it seems that we are the Achronim, I would say, are balanced. You have to know your Achron. Okay, there's some incredibly helpful work in if you ever have a book called Michtav MeElyahu, Eliyahu Dessau, and the English translation is called Strive for Truth. He has a whole chapter on how to present the biblical persona, especially the avos and imahos, to young children. Okay, and how do we read them ourselves? Right, every year throughout Sefer Bereishis, you're hearing drushas and shol about how we derive messages from these from their deeds. Okay, so I would like to start closing up and giving my segue for what's going to be the third week and open up for questions shortly. And the point is that Chazal have an agenda. There is an agenda. Chazal are very capable of seeing that a pasuk in the Torah says that Reuven slept with his father's wife, says his concubine in that story, but she's called his wife earlier in Bereishis, Nishay Aviv. And Chazal have certain agendas. Remember, this is the beginning of Bereishis. I learned that pasuk in third grade in Yeshiva Soloveitchik. And I'm not sure I was ready to understand what Reuven had done. I do remember my teacher, Gveret Shisha, telling us that Reuven, I did get this, Reuven was jealous for his mother to be accepted by his father. And when Rachel, who was Yaakov's favorite, we all understood that, when Rachel, who was Yaakov's favorite, died, Reuven just assumed that now his mother will be Yaakov's favorite. But when Yaakov moved in with Bilhah, Reuven thought that that wasn't proper. We got that. Now, what did Reuven do at that point? I'm not sure an eight-year-old could really figure out regardless of what they're forcing our eight-year-olds to study now in the public school system. I'm not going to get into that. It's not the purpose of the shiur tonight. But when I was in third grade, they didn't feel it was appropriate to discuss what Vayishkav es Bilhah and Pilegesh Aviv meant. So the rabbis presented a possibility for pedagogy to say that, you know, it doesn't really matter what Reuven did. He was very zealous for his mother's honor, right? You could read the Book of Jubilees. You can read this Testament of the 12 Tribes. You can read some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and you'll see they all take it literally. But what all these commentaries have in common is that Reuven seems to be judged somewhat favorably because he had the good intentions of his mother's honor at heart. But poor Reuven, he's pachas kamayim. He never comes through. He always has good intention. He has good intention to save Yosef. So take him on your shoulders and take him home. And instead, he comes up with a fakakta plan about how to get Yosef home. Didn't work. He wants to bring Binyamin home, but I kill my two sons if I don't. Reuven, he's going to lose his bechorah over that. Pachas kamayim. That's Reuven. But the rabbis were willing to give him a pass because he had good intentions, right? The Tanakh is subjective, Chevra. It ought to be. The Tanakh is not a history book. It's a book of morality. Right? So it's subjective. Like I mentioned last week, the way Divrei Hayamim is subjective about events that take place in Sefer Shmuel. Okay? We are all works in progress, and so are our ancestors. If Avraham made a mistake by not mentioning Sarah in chapter 15, right? Listen to the beautiful continuum of our avos in Sefer Bereishis. If Avraham makes a mistake by saying to God, God, you keep telling me great nation, but I have no children. Oy, Avraham, how different Jewish history could have been if you had only said, instead of I have no children, yeah? Someone tell me.
We have no children.
We have no children. Sarah and I have no children, God. So what are all these promises? At which time Hashem would have said, Avram, don't say that. You and Sarah will have children. That isn't your destiny. So that in the very next chapter, when Sarah suggests to take Hagar, because maybe when God promised you you'd be a great nation, maybe that should be with another woman. Avram didn't know any different. Hashem didn't tell him any different by that time. So Avram went along with it. He needed to be pushed into it, says Ramban. It doesn't say Vayikach Avram, it says Vatikach Sarah, Ishas Avram, etc., etc. Right, but still, we see that Avram went along with it. But had Avram said, we have no children, at which time God would have responded, don't say that, Avram, you and Sarah will have children. Then Avram would have told Sarah, no, I have some insider information for you. I wasn't going to tell you this early because I don't know when it's going to happen. But you and I will have children. So I'm not doing any of this Hagar stuff. One simple little change. Instead of Anochi Holech Ariri, Anachnu Holchim Aririm. Rashi has Sarah telling Avraham this. when she says Chamasi Alecha later in the chapter, in chapter 16 with Hagar. So Bereishis is a work in progress. When Yitzchak prays for infertility, it's Vayetar Yitzchak Lashem Lenochach Ishto Ki Akarahi. He's not praying for himself. He knows he's going to have a child. Ki B'Yitzchak Yikorei L'Chazara. But I don't want it to be with another woman. So Yitzchak is the only one of the Avos who doesn't deal with his infertility the way his father and the way his son do. Right? Okay, so, and then when Yaakov seems to deal with infertility, especially with regards to Rachel, in an insensitive way, the Chazal were right on top of it. Remember Yaakov's reaction to Rachel's torment and Rachel's pain? He says, "Ha'atachas Elokim ani." Who said almost those exact same words? "Ha'atachas Elokim anochi." Who said those precisely those same words?
Elkanah.
Yosef, when the brothers thought that Yosef would kill them after Yaakov died. And they lied to him, says the Gemara in Yevamos, it was a Shamas Mipnei HaShalom, that they said, our father said, don't kill us. But Yaakov never knew that Yosef was sold. And even if he did know, I don't know if he would have accused Yosef of wanting to kill them all. And if he thought that Yosef would kill them all, surely it would have made more sense for him to tell Yosef not to kill them, not to tell the brothers to tell Yosef not to kill them. It was a bald-faced lie. But Yosef reacted, and he said the same words Yaakov said to Rachel. Hatachas Elokim Anochi. And Bereishis Rabbah picks up on it. Bereishis Rabbah is very, very keen on this. You've heard of Robert Alter, the one who just came out with a new English translation to the whole Tanakh. He wrote in his first book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, he said that he was machadesh, all these nuances and all these trends. Please, it's a thin little book. There's a big fat book called Trends in Genesis and Beyond by Dr. David Sykes. That's a book on this topic. You should try to get it. Trends in Genesis and Beyond, Dr. David Sykes. Anyway, Robert Alter brags about how sensitive and how close reader he is. Come on, he didn't meet enough midrashim. He complains that the rabbis weren't sensitive to the nuances of biblical ironies. What are you talking about? The rabbis were keen on this all the time. He just didn't read enough midrashim, right? So when Yaakov didn't behave like Yitzchak, so the rabbis were saying, so you've got to suffer for that. There's going to be some hurt for that. Okay, all right. So that is the work in progress, if you will, of what Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov represent. Okay, so part three, I'll just give you a little introduction now since we're at the 45-minute mark and I'd like to leave some time for questions. Part three is going to be to compare two stories in Sefer Shmuel. One is Shaul's behavior with Amalek and two, David's behavior with Bathsheba. And there is a medrash, a form of this medrash appears in the Gemara in Yuma I mentioned before, where the rabbis say, not the angels say, V'chim yesh masu panim, God, why does Shaul get beat down so hard for what looks like relatively minor sins, and David, his kingdom continues, even though his sins seem to be so much more egregious? So we'll take a look at that in the next time as well, and we'll just look apart at the two personalities. We mentioned before that same Gemara that says that Shaul was a greater specimen of humanity than David, and Chazal say that if Mashiach can only come if he has a kupa shel shrotzim munach mitzavarov. Yes, let's say what in English that would mean something like a can of worms or bones in the closet, right? What does that mean? I thought Mashiach is supposed to be perfect. I thought Moshe is supposed to be perfect. Well, guess what? Nobody's perfect. So I'm not sure how to interpret this thing about Mashiach, but it means that you have to be a little humble because there's some questionable thing in the background of everybody. So let's be a little more tolerant and understanding of the foibles of others, rather than wait till they call us out on similar behavior. This is a political issue all the time. So let's keep hypocrisy out of the question. All right. So that's going to close my discussion of the biblical persona. I don't know if this came up last class, but I've been teaching a course at YU called Great Biblical Personalities. Jesse, you said I'm teaching at YU since 1993. I'm actually teaching there since 1983, just because I've taught this course about 20 times over these years. And I've kept records of the last question I always give on the final, which is, who is the biblical character you admire most and why? And it's really amazing. I mean, I don't know if it's because of the way I'm presenting. I just don't know. But in all of these courses, and by now it's a few hundred students, in all of these courses, there's one biblical character that stands out. He's something like 45% of the responses. And this is actually a question on the test that you can't get wrong. You just give an intelligent kind of answer of why you admire this person and move on to the next question. Who would you think is that person that 45% of these 350, 370 students have admired the most over the last 30 years?
I would think Moshe, but I'm leaning towards David.
So it's neither Moshe nor David.
Aaron.
It's not Aaron.
Yona,
you're getting closer.
Yeheskel.
Yeheskel, you're getting even closer. Now, it has to do with what I've been discussing here. It's not about the perfection. It's about the struggle. This person is probably gives you the best glimpse of his personality for the sheer length of his book. And his mindset. You get into his brain more than any other Navi, by far.
Yeshayahu?
Shmuel?
Yirmiyahu.
I think the last one said it, but I couldn't hear it fully.
Yirmiyahu
is correct. Yirmiyahu has, it's amazing, there are a lot of biblical characters. And for about 45% is Yirmiyahu. Again, it could be because of the way I present it. Yirmiyahu happens to be one of my favorites too, but just the conflict in read chapter 20 and you'll see what I mean. Read chapter 3 of Eicha and you'll see what I mean. Just and you know, you can say if his mission was to save the temple, to save the malchus, to save the land, to save the for us from exile, he was a miserable failure. But that was never his mission. It was never possible to be his mission. We already see from numerous stories in Sefer Melachim that all of those things were kemat a foregone conclusion based on the way things were going for the previous few hundred years. His mission was singular, to instill the next two generations with the hope that they will return. And everyone who returned, whether it's Daniel or Zechariah, in their books, they all write about a man named Yirmiyahu who was spit on, he was put in the stocks, he was beaten, he was thrown in the pits, he was thrown in mud pits and in clay pits, he was thrown in water, he was jailed, he spent the entire few years before the Chorban in jail, and yet he never gave up hope on his people. And that I think is the biblical persona we need to inculcate, and that I think is why he's so admired. Okay, I will leave now some time for questions.
Okay, I have some remark. Not a
Yaakov, before you ask, Jesse, how do you want to do this? Do you want me to take the questions or?
Yeah, let's put them in the chat and we'll read them one by one. So I think people will start to unmute all at the same time. We have one speaker, so let's have him speak. Then we'll go through the chats.
Okay, or if I see someone raise their hand, I can... why should we suffer till today for mistakes made by the Avos? Can you give me an example of of what suffering we are experiencing because of the Avos?
Well, you pointed out that because Avraham didn't include Sarah in his plea, that all of Jewish history would have changed.
Oh, okay. That sounds like the Ramban. All of Jewish history would have changed because there would never have been a Yishmael. That's what that means.
Right, which is pretty major.
And not only that,
but that's just a continuum. That's a motion. There is a Yishmael, and he is what he is. Ramban is a little harsher on this, which is because of Hagar's mistreatment. That's more, I think, in line with your question, if I'm correct. And that's a big chiddush for Ramban. Ramban says that really Christians, imagine writing this in the 1300s with all the things that Ramban experienced with Pablo Christiani and being forced to flee. And he says that really we should be ruling over the Christians because Yaakov took the blessing from Esav. But the reason why we are subservient to Christianity is because in Parshas Vayishlach, the abject behavior of Yaakov, rather than relying on the promises of Hashem at the end of Parshas Vayitzeh, he was so concerned with Esav killing Emal Bonim that he just veritably returned the blessings that caused him all those problems in the first place, veritably returned them to Esav. And that's why we're subjugated. That's a great burden. Seyu chavoshes haderech lifnei vanecha. But at the same time, we're here. We're the only ones here because of the Avos. Right? Tell me anyone else that was there at the time of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov that's here now.
I if you don't mind, we try to give the patriarchs the same traits which we would like to have today. It is nonsense to my mind, a complete nonsense. For example, the list of morality was not yet established at all. They probably had a good idea what would be good or not, but the list did not exist as it started to exist
Okay, Yaakov, let me explain.
Okay. That's basically what I wanted to say.
Okay. So the issue at hand is that the patriarchs were, according to some opinions in the Talmud, had some kind of connection to God. Which Reish Lakish calls the chariot,
right.
to harness the some kind of knowledge of God. Now, that can be understood on many different levels.
Right.
Hashem told Yitzchak that your father, Ekev Asher Shema Avraham Bekoli, Vayishmor Mishmarti Mitzvosai Chukosai Vesorosai. Right, so you know, you can imagine some creative rabbis saying all of the good kind deeds and all the good things that Avraham did. On a pshat level, I get what you're saying, is that they listened that he did a bris milah, you know, he kept the seven Noahide laws that we feel were incumbent upon them, but their faith to carry on in the face of such incredible impediments to their plans. God keeps telling them you're going to be a great nation, and at every turn they run into conflict. Lives were, you know, look, maybe there was some peace and tranquility in the middle of all that, but there was one pasuk, Vayeshev Yaakov, Bikesh Yaakov Leshev Bashalva. You know, we had maybe a few hours of shalva.
To my mind, it's much more curious the things which happened already after Sinai, when the people did not follow at all. You see what was clearly said. Don't do it. Don't do it. No, they did. And David, who was mentioned here positively, was one of those who did many things Shmuel said, don't do it.
Nobody. Okay, listen, Yaakov, you're concentrating on a few of the don'ts.
It's important. I will explain to you why.
Okay, in 40 years, the Israelites tested God 10 times. In today's times, maybe we test God 10 times every week. I don't know, but this is what rabbis do in their sermons on Shabbos.
It's us, not God. You see,
Yaakov, hold on.
What he definitely wanted us to do. You see, sometimes.
Okay, hold on. This is what the rabbis do in their sermons on Shabbos. You know, we look at certain behavior patterns. Some of the things I did with you tonight about Yitzchak learning from Avram's mistakes, or Yaakov sticking to his work with Lavan and sticking with Leah, even though he didn't like her. So, you know, making things work. So there are these things that this is what sermons are in Sefer Bereishis. But you're right. I believe that it might be a mistake on our part to, let's say, impose upon the patriarchs our modes of communication. Let's say. I mean, if I would jump into my tent and tell my wife, "Hurry up, make food for these three strangers I just met," I wouldn't talk to my wife that way. Okay. But you know, with the way Avram talks in Parshas Vayera, bespeaks maybe a certain partnership that the two of them had, where Sarah was right on board with all of Avraham's outreach with whatever he used to do, and maybe today a wife would say, make it yourself if you're going to talk to me that way, you know. But that's not, you know, that's not. I know you want to say, well, you want to have it both ways, Rabbi. You want to learn from Avraham when it suits you in a sermon, but you don't want to impose your methods of communication. All right, look, if God told me I'm going to have a child with my wife after many years of marriage, I would run home and tell her. Why didn't Avraham tell his wife? Why did she have to overhear it from the angels? You know, I think, I'll tell you another radical interpretation. I think he did tell her. When she heard from the tent that she was going to have a baby, uh-huh. Right? She wasn't acting incredulously about a prediction. No. Avraham had guests every single day. He had 3 guests, 5 guests, 7 guests. And every single day when those guests got up, they would bless Avram and say, Avraham, I'm sure by this time next year, Sarah's going to have a baby. Every single time that Sarah used to heard that 500 times already. Only this time, it was from angel. This time, it was real. So it was bad, you know, bad on her part to doubt it. Okay, I'm going to go to Sina.
Thank you, Rabbi, for a great shul. My question is, why do we see a pattern where throughout Tanakh, among the Avot, Avraham and Yaakov are more emphasized? I mean, for example, you brought up the last pasuk from Micha, "Ditein emet le Yaakov, chesed le Avraham, asher nishvata." I read the Rashi, and the Rashi says that asher nishvata is an allusion to Akedat Yitzchak. What's the reason that among the Avot, the two extremes are sort of more emphasized throughout Tanakh?
I think the answer to your question is complicated. It's a great question. And I think it has to do with the fact that of Yitzchak favoring Esav over Yaakov. The many different reasons why he favors Esav. The simple pshat is probably because Esav puts food on the table, like the pasuk says. Because that's Yitzchak's job, and Esav did it for him. So he loved Esav. Whether that's considered a shochad or not, that blinded him to the differences between his sons, I'm not sure. That what I just said is balaturim and das sekenimi baliatosis. Yitzchak knew the difference between his sons, but he allowed Esav to bribe him with this wonderful venison, and the Ramban seems to intimate that what Yitzchak saw in Yaakov, Nishtam Yoshev Ohalim, is too much of himself. Take a look again at Shimshon Ufal Hirsch on the pasuk VaYigdalu HaNe'arim in Parshas Toldos. He saw too much of himself. Right. So. And he said, we can't have Avram Yitzchak and Yitzchak. we have to have Avram, Yitzchak, and Avraham. Right? He recognized he was an Olam Tmima, he was too perfect, if you will. And I need someone who's going to go out of the tent and be a go-getter like Avraham was. So that's why you see in Bereishis, you see that Yaakov and Avraham share many experiences. The book ends. Right? They both go to Egypt in time of famine. They both marry extra wives to deal with infertility. Right? They both deal with rootlessness and traveling the same way. They both have dealings with Paro, and they share a lot of there's most of the narratives of Bereishis are dedicated to those two, and very little to Yitzchak. So Yitzchak is the linchpin, an important one, but I think I hope that answers your question to some extent, and it goes a long way with explaining why Yitzchak favored Esav. He thought, I'll get Esav, don't worry, Esav, I'll be mishmashpi on him. We'll never know what Esav would have turned out had he not been driven away by the bracha that was taken. So I don't want to second guess Rivka. She understood Virav Yavot Sa'ir to be that not only should he get the Birkas Avraham, Avraham, but I think he should also get Tala Shemayim and Shemane Aretz for Rav Dagon V'Sirosh. I think that Yaakov deserves to get both brachos. And Yitzchak said, no, I want to split the brachos. I'm going to give Yaakov Birkas Avraham, and I'm going to give Esav Birkas Tala Shemayim and Shemane Aretz. And we'll see how that goes. All right, but we'll never know. You know, I don't want to second guess Rivka, but if Jews do well when given equal opportunity, it's because Rivka vouchsafed for us the bracha of Tala Shemayim and Shemane Haaretz. And she's always looking down at how Jews are spending their money.
Can I ask a quick follow-up?
Please.
Does that reasoning imply that when we think about Zichud Avod, Mary the Fathers, Avraham and Yaakov contribute more to it, or do all three of them contribute equally to it?
I'd have to say all three equally, but in different ways. May I direct your attention, please, to Shabbos Daf Peites, and look there for an incredible, incredible, beautiful Gemara about Yitzchak and his Limud Zchut, Zchuyot, for Klal Yisrael forever, in a way that Avram and Yaakov chose not to find or couldn't find. All right, Shabbos Daf Peites. Anyone would like any other question, or maybe we can, yes, last question, Camelia.
My question is as follows. If Avraham didn't include Sarah, how do we know that was actually a problem? Because for two reasons. One is men are commanded to have children and women are not. And we have the example also later on with Elkanah, and when he was talking to Hannah, because he already had children with Penina. So he wasn't really concerned. He didn't have this concern. And the second thing is, if he didn't include it, like maybe he was talking about her also, but he was just talking about himself because that's how they spoke at that time. Maybe it was just a colloquial way of speaking.
I think your question is a good segue to explain that Avraham and Elkanah, this is not a question about who's commanded or who, remember, this is before Matan Torah in Avram's time. It's a question of sensitivity. Elkanah is being insensitive. When he says, am I not as good for you as 10 sons? There are different ways to interpret that, but that's when she starts praying, because that when he says that to her, she realizes that he's given up on her. He says, I'll take care of you as if though you have 10 sons looking after you, or I'll love you as much as if you gave me 10 sons. However it is, he's given up hope on her. So that's when she decides, you know what? It's all in my hands. And that's where she changes her destiny. And that's the Haftarah of Rosh Hashanah, because that's how we change our destiny on Rosh Hashanah. So with Avraham, it's also a question of sensitivity. I think that's what rabbis are supposed to do in their sermons, is to learn, is to tell husbands, you know, every decision you make, you always, from the day you break the glass under the chuppah, you have to ask, how does this reflect upon my life's partner? And she should think the same way. And that's you know, Rashi beautifully points out when it says that Avram pitched his tent, it's spelled a halo in the Masorah as if though it's he pitched her tent. And he says that, Rashi says that whenever Avram did something, he always did it first for Sarah. So that's a good idea. It's good for both spouses to do. You're pouring wine glasses. So pour her glass first, or pour his glass first. Pour the other one first. Right? As long as you're both getting the same wine. Don't necessarily lop the meatballs on her plate. Maybe she doesn't want those meatballs. I don't know. But if you're pouring the same ginger ale, pour for him first, you know. So that we learned from Avram, but then he lost that sensitivity later on, and you know what? He's called out on it. And that's what good Rosh does. Okay. Chevra, thank you so much for sticking around.
Rabbi, thank you so much. Great share as usual. Look forward to next week and your two examples from Sefer Shmuel. It's going to be very exciting. Hope everyone can join then. Look forward to seeing you all again next Tuesday, same time, 7:45.